It is now 1 p.m. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind coming up.
Hey, everybody. This is Kevin O'Donohue back with you with The Positive Mind, bringing you some ideas, concepts, and guests. Try and help you lead a more positively minded life. And in the studio today, a guest, Robin Stern and Ben Starr.
Hello, hello.
Ben Starr.
And Robin Stern is here. Robin Stern is a psychotherapist here in Manhattan and Garden City, New York, and she's a specialist in what's called body dysmorphic disorder, and we're going to get to her in a minute. But I wanted to tell you that we did respond to your request that we get some women on this show. And here we are. We're starting off a women's series right here with Robin Stern to talk to us about the body and women's bodies and distortions of bodies and the importance of bodies and what people tell themselves about their bodies. Think about it. We look in a mirror, what, four times a day, five times a day?
At least.
At least four. Or you look in a storefront window. Here, those of us here in Manhattan, do you ever look at yourself in the mirror or in a storefront window and say, that doesn't look like me?
Of course.
Really? Robin, yeah. Have you had that experience?
Yes, I have.
What is that all about? I mean, I think I look totally different. Then I see myself in a storefront window and I said, that's me?
I think oftentimes how we perceive ourselves is different than how others perceive ourselves. And that will ultimately lead us into the conversation about what body dysmorphic disorder is and the perceptions that one sees themselves in.
So here's a question. When was the first mirror invented?
I'm going to throw that to you.
Yeah.
I guess the Egyptians probably.
Well, the Egyptians did it 3000 BC, but they had already invented it 3000 years before that.
Really?
Yes, but it wasn't the modern-day mirror we know. So can you believe it that the first mirror was a stone? It was a rock.
I guess with a sheen of water on it, that probably would reflect, right?
It would reflect. And then a polished stone is even more reflective. And then they had water, clear water, in a metal container where you could see your reflection. But the modern-day mirror, let's leave that as a question. Maybe half the way through the show, people will call us and tell us, when was the modern-day mirror invented for mass marketing? It wasn't too long ago, for those of you who are curious. So today we want to talk about the mirror and who's that person in the mirror and what does that mirror do to you and the way you look at yourself. Robin, tell us about body dysmorphic disorder.
So body dysmorphic disorder is when someone has a preoccupation with one or more perceived defects or physical flaws in their physical appearance that are not observable to the everyday person.
So what that mean? Like they see things in themselves, they see defects or faults or flaws that they perceive that others just don't observe ever.
Right. I mean, they may be minimal or they may not even exist at all. But they get very consumed by them to the point where it impacts their quality of life and their ability to function fully and could affect their social life, their ability to work, go to school, engage in relationships. Their overall quality of life is extremely diminished by these thoughts that they have about themselves.
So it really affects your professional life. It can really affect your family life. It can really affect your social life.
Absolutely. And the thing is, oftentimes people with body dysmorphic disorder, or otherwise known as BDD, there's a huge shame component to it. So people don't really often want to share that they even have these thoughts or concerns because they're often dismissed by people saying that it's a vanity disorder, which is the furthest thing from it. I don't think anybody who has this disorder is saying that they don't want to leave their house and they don't want to engage in the world. And I think that's a little bit different than being vain. And I would hope to debunk some of those myths, how people view people who have this disorder. But with that being said, I hope that this show can shed light on a disorder still so under-recognized and not understood by not only the everyday person, but people even in the mental health community.
How would we distinguish between someone who is BDD and is suffering from an actual disorder versus your standard person who just may not like some certain aspect of their appearance. Because I think we all, on some level, there's traits that we all feel we could improve about
Absolutely.
Our appearance. But, you know, for others, it becomes a full-on disorder. So where does that come into play? Where do you draw the line?
And I think that's a really great question that you ask, because oftentimes, which is very it's hard for the BDD sufferer to hear this, but oftentimes people will say everyone has this. And it's not the case. There are people that may not like how they look, be slightly self-conscious about certain aspects of their appearance. But when it becomes a full-blown disorder is when it meets certain diagnostic criteria. So the preoccupation is excessive. You'll see people with body dysmorphic disorder spending 8 to 12 hours a day staring in a mirror or a reflective surface.
Wow.
It's very, it's like you can lose yourself in it. And you also engage in compulsions, avoidance behaviors. And you become slightly like a shell of yourself because you're so consumed with yourself. And it's, again, not a vanity thing. It's not that someone just wants to look like the most beautiful person in the world. They're just so uncomfortable with how they look. And it's really impacting the way they function.
And I think you could probably ask everybody walking the planet, especially, certainly everybody here in New York, you know, is there one thing about your body or your face that you don't like? And I think everybody would say something. You know, I mean.
And I agree with that 100%. Where it becomes a disorder, which is important to know, is when you can't function because of that. I think people who have aspects of their appearance that they dislike, that's okay, and that's a normal thing. And so that's where this gray area, who has body dysmorphic disorder, who just has normal appearance concerns. When you can't get out of bed or can't go into the world or are housebound or unable to leave your home and have to put yourself in positions where you're under certain lighting or camouflaging yourself, then we have to sit back and say something else is going on. Mm-hmm. And that's where it leads to this.
And usually the mental health professional will take seriously the claim that I can't leave my house or I'm doing a lot of repetitious behaviors. But when they say, oh, it's because, you know, I have a little mustache under my nose or something like that, is that sort of diminished or poo-pooed? I mean, is the mental health community receptive to this diagnosis? And
so as someone
is there problems with it?
Yeah, someone who's a therapist, and actually I do have body dysmorphic disorder myself, I have to say that it is often minimized and not taken so seriously. You'll hear by multiple professionals, I've had clients that have told me that people say to them, you need to be concerned with something more important than that. Well, that is minimizing someone's suffering.
Right. It's like if you said to an alcoholic, you know, there are more important things than you drinking every day.
Absolutely.
And so that's not going to get anybody anywhere. What does get somewhere? Well, first let's go, what are some of the activities that a BDD person, body dysmorphic disorder person, does every day?
So oftentimes, person will wake up in the morning and their initial impulse is to want to go into the mirror. And when I say go into the mirror, a person with body dysmorphic disorder often has a very unhealthy relationship with the mirror. They're within inches of the mirror engaging and looking at themselves. When you're looking in the mirror in that capacity, you're not able to objectively see how you look. So oftentimes that is how they start their day, which is a big issue, because if they don't like what they see, which oftentimes when you're not in treatment, you don't like what you see, you don't begin your day. And that might lead you to avoidant behaviors or camouflaging behaviors or even going back into bed and not getting up to move through
your day. Just hiding from the world.
Yes. There's a lot of avoidance behaviors.
So there's the shame. There's the shame, right? You see something, a defect.
Absolutely.
A defect. And so the person is saying, look, this part of me is not perfect and I am not suitable for social interactions. No, I'm not fit to be around somebody. I mean, is that what the
Absolutely.
Dialogue is?
Common phrases and common things I've heard for people who have body dysmorphic disorder is they're disgusting. They look like a monster. They're repulsive. These are very highly, you know,
Charged, dismissive and judgmental.
Right. And can you imagine feeling that about yourself?
Yeah.
And then being able to go forward in your day? It's very difficult, especially if you're not receiving treatment for it and you're not understanding that you actually have a mental disorder and that it's not something physically wrong with you, which is what most people think when they initially have these thoughts about themselves.
So do most of these people have pocket mirrors? I mean, why not just get rid of mirrors?
Well, we have in a sense, Kevin. I don't know if you've noticed this, but what I see increasingly is people using their cell phone cameras as mirrors. Do you notice that, Robin?
Absolutely. And when I was diagnosed about 15 years ago, I was blessed that we didn't really have smartphones. So I didn't have that. But I used to carry around a pocket mirror.
Yeah.
And, you know, doing treatment, that was one of the things that I had to put away. I can no longer carry one with me anymore. Because I would spend multiple times during the day just getting caught in my reflection, and then it would stop me from doing what I needed to do.
The smartphone certainly has become the pocket mirror of today among younger generations. I mean, you see people all the time. You ride the subway, you see it all the time. People check out they put on the selfie camera, and they, you know, they look at themselves.
I had a mirror on it.
Yeah. Well, it's not a mirror. It's the camera.
Right.
You have the camera that faces.
Oh, the selfie thing.
Sure. You have the camera that faces you.
Okay.
Which is another hallmark these days, actually, of body dysmorphic disorder. You'll find a lot of people taking thousands of selfies.
I've had
clients tell me in a matter of an hour, they'll take 300 and above selfies just to see how they're looking in their reflection.
So maybe that could be added to the DSM as a symptom. Like, how often are you using your cell phone to take a picture of yourself? How many selfies are you posting on
social media, which we'll definitely discuss tomorrow, because there's definitely a correlation between the two.
It must have actually aggravated and in some ways increased the number of BDD cases. I can only imagine the rise of social media.
I think so, and I think hopefully we can get people out there to realize that this is a very serious disorder and that we need to do more work to educate not only the day-to-day person, the mental health person, dermatologists, plastic surgeons.
Sure.
Let's talk about this. First of all, we have to congratulate and thank you, because you're being really courageous. You're saying openly, I'm somebody who suffered from this. We rarely get somebody in the studio who can give us firsthand experience. So we really appreciate this. This is really courageous.
Thank
you. It's clearly your commitment, because everybody out there can hear your passion. I mean, you came in a half hour ago and you said the whole show in a half an hour. And here we are going into new territory, and you're still this passion. So let's start with you. I mean, how did it start with you? What did you notice?
So I noticed in college that I seemed to be very into my reflective surfaces when I would walk to classes, and I would always look to see how I looked. I felt that I just looked different from the day-to-day person. I felt that I looked different from everybody else, and I didn't think anything really was wrong with that. And then when I was about 20 years old, I had a situation where I got electrolysis and I had a reaction to it. And my skin, I felt, broke out to the point where I actually didn't leave my home for a month.
Inside for a month.
Inside. And my parents didn't know what to do. And at that point, I had no idea what I was suffering from. And my doctor at the time just gave me medication and told me that I should be concerned with something more important than that.
No, he didn't.
Yeah. So again, minimizing my concerns. I still didn't know that body dysmorphic disorder exists, and that's what I had. But I was always drawn to the self-help section of the bookstore, and I actually came across The Broken Mirror and realized upon reading
it. What is that?
It's a body dysmorphic disorder book, and it's the go-to everyone should get. And I said, oh my gosh, this is who I am. This is what I have. Mm. And I was in therapy at that point. And I showed my therapist, and she said, no, this is not who you are. And fast forward about a year and a half, where my mom, through her own therapist, got me a referral to a great OCD treatment facility. And they diagnosed me at 22 years old with body dysmorphic disorder. And that was when I had validation for everything that I have been through.
And how did things change from there for you? I mean, that must have been such a relief.
I finally felt like someone understood me, and this was not just these thoughts in my head, and I felt like at home. I finally felt that I had the right treatment for something that I was suffering for so long. I was always dismissed in saying that I had depression, but it would always come back to my appearance. So having this diagnosis and having the proper treatment led me to ultimately have a better quality of life.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Robin Stern. She's a licensed clinical social worker, psychotherapist. She practices here in the New York area, as well as Garden City, Long Island. And we're talking about body dysmorphic disorder, which is really a fascinating topic that we've only lightly explored in the past, and I'm so glad you're here, Robin, to really help us delve into this more deeply. My question for you is, what would be, say, someone who is suffering from body dysmorphic disorder, what would be some examples of coping mechanisms and things that they would do if they were not in treatment, right? Like, the how would this behavior be expressed, and what would be some signs or some symptoms?
So if you notice that your loved one is spending excess amount of time in the mirror, they're asking for a lot of reassurance regarding physical features, and you notice that they're pretty minimal, and they begin to avoid going places or maybe don't want to go out with the family or do other things, then you would want to kind of explore that more. There's the BDDQ, which is a self-administered questionnaire that you can actually find on the International OCD Foundation website.
Okay. That's called the BDDQ?
Right. It's just a body dysmorphic disorder questionnaire. And that will give you basic information to assess where you may lie. But ultimately, you do need to go to a trained psychotherapist to get the proper diagnosis.
Sure.
So it is different than OCD, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But it strikes me as such a private affliction because, you know, at the heart of so many mental disorders and mental issues, mental problems, is shame. But with body dysmorphic disorder, you're visiting shame hundreds of times a day. You know, you're going to the mirror and you're always going to be disappointed. You're always going to find something wrong. So, and you know, it just sounds, can you talk a little bit about the privacy aspect of it?
So the core theme of body dysmorphic disorder is shame. So people don't go out. What I'm doing right now by speaking is
fantastic.
Actually going against what my body dysmorphic disorder would ever want me to do.
Right.
So I think that's helped me in my recovery. I do consider myself in recovery, and I think that helps me because that I was so ashamed of having this. These thoughts, these compulsions, they overpowered me at points in my life and made me feel very, like I use the word, disgusted or shameful. Yeah. And by speaking about it, I'm owning it. I'm not allowing it to control me anymore, but I'm also allowing people to understand what this is. And I think there is this shame component because I think people over time don't feel comfortable talking about these perceived defects. And they're thinking that if they talk about it, it will actually bring notice to them.
Yes.
And then people will notice this perceived defect they have. But let me state by saying that no one would ever be diagnosed with this disorder if you generally were deformed. And I always tell my clients that. If my client was deformed in some way and had these deformities that they claim, they would not meet criteria in the DSM-5 for body dysmorphic disorder.
Because to be dysmorphic, it has to really be observing something that's not there.
Right, or slightly.
Right.
So their perception that they're a monster or that their flaws are extremely apparent would never meet diagnostic criteria to have this disorder. So I try to give them that sense of comfort. You'll hear me talk more about it tomorrow in terms of reassurance seeking. I try to give minimal reassurance, but that's a reassurance in the diagnosis. You would not be diagnosed with this if you actually were deformed.
So if you have a birthmark on your cheek – and you're obsessed with it and checking it and, you know, ashamed of it. Would that qualify?
I think we would have to look at additional things that the person is doing. I mean, how apparent is it? Is this birthmark extremely large? And what things are getting in the way of their life?
Mm-hmm.
If they just don't like it and they're just not happy with it, okay. And even if they go for maybe a procedure to get it removed,
right.
That doesn't necessarily mean they have body dysmorphic disorder.
Mm-hmm.
But it depends what other aspects of their life and functioning are being inhibited by this.
Yeah, and we say in the trade, clinically significant distress.
Absolutely.
If a person is having seriously clinically significant distress, and usually that shows up in academics, professional life, social life, family life.
Absolutely.
Even financial life.
But like I said, I think you brought it up, the whole thing of keeping it secretive. And so that's what leads to a lot of misdiagnosis. That's what leads to a lot of people not sharing that they have this. And you'll hear people, I've heard my clients say, I've never talked about this with anyone ever before. And I understand that because this is an uncomfortable, very intimate part of who you are. And you truly believe that you look defective. So why would you want to share that with someone? You don't believe that this is a mental disorder. You believe that this is a physical deformity.
So the treatment really has to be person to person.
Absolutely.
I mean, you say there's exposure therapy.
So the evidence-based treatment is cognitive behavioral therapy and exposure response prevention, which is why it's very similar to OCD because it's a very similar treatment model. But it has to be personalized to each individual. I always love to add acceptance commitment therapy work because that allows someone to accept what is, not to necessarily just tolerate a lot of the uncertainty, tolerate a lot of the difficulty. Mindfulness, as well as using some DBT, distress tolerance skills.
Tell us about yours. I loved your example of what your therapist made you do.
Oh, okay. So actually, when I spoke at the OCD conference this past summer, we actually did exposures. And one of my famous exposures was putting red pencil on my face because my issue was around my skin, whether it was pimples or blotchiness. So what he would have me do was to put red pencil on aspects of my face to, I guess the idea was to either make the perceived flaws more noticeable or give me flaws.
Or simulate the blemishes.
Correct.
Yeah.
And then we had fun going to Costco and he would have me talk to people. And what the idea was, and it's so funny because it wasn't like it was movie makeup, so it looked really slightly ridiculous because it was pencil.
Right.
And it was obvious that
right.
it wasn't
yeah.
like anything. But no one seemed to notice it. No one seemed to have a different interaction with me just because I put this on my face.
Sure.
And so what the idea was, obviously, we look at your anxiety before, we look at your anxiety during the exposure, and we look at your anxiety after the exposure. So before, my anxiety was probably, if you're looking at 0 to 100, was like 100 because I did not want to be wearing that. Once I got out there, it was still pretty high, but as I was out there talking to people, engaged in conversation, my anxiety started to diminish.
That's fascinating.
And that's the idea of exposure response prevention.
Because you got out there and you realized, wait a minute, no one else really cares. I'm the one who's putting so much emphasis on this.
Correct. And that's what the exposures really teach you. It teaches you that you can expose yourself to your biggest fear within reason. Again, we're not going to do anything that's dangerous.
Sure. Sure.
But we're going to expose yourself to the biggest fear and we're going to habituate to that level of anxiety so that the level of anxiety will slowly diminish. And you keep doing this. You don't just do that one time. You do this multiple times. So when I'm doing exposure work with clients, I want them to do it daily. I don't want this like, oh, great, you did it one time and you don't have anxiety, you're done. No, you keep doing it.
Mm-hmm. And there's, I guess, also the kind of the relative lesson there is, well, hey, if I'm able to go out in public with pencil scribbled all over my face and no one makes a big deal out of it and no one looks at me like I have three heads, right, then when I'm out in public without the pencil on my face, it's even less so. It's
Absolutely.
Even less of a big deal.
Absolutely. And that comes in also the cognitive part of cognitive behavioral therapy. It's challenging those distortions. And we need to do the behavioral work and the experiment to say to show the patient and client, look, this is the challenge to that thought. We have to look at your thoughts and we have to challenge this faulty thinking so that we can have an alternative explanation.
Perfect. Perfect. We did a show on shyness not too long ago, and we got the biggest response we ever got because more and more people are shy than we think, at least 50% of the population.
Wow.
And again, it gets down to exposure. You need to be exposed to the situations you're so much afraid of. Again, if you pick too big a mountain to climb, it doesn't work. But you want to acclimate to the level that you're experiencing on your own. In the session with a therapist or in the social situation and take it from there. And gradually just the repetition will reduce.
Right. Absolutely. Because gradual exposure is key to treatment. If someone's biggest fear is going out in public with pencil on their face, the last thing you're going to do with a client is have that as your first exposure.
Right.
You would work together to have an exposure hierarchy and let's say maybe have 20 exposures or 20 avoidant behaviors you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And you would then scale them 0 to 100 or 0 to 10, 0 being the least anxiety provoking, 10 or 100 being the most,
mm-hmm.
and you work your way up.
Yeah.
So you never want to expose your client to their most fearful situation.
I love it. Because then they're not going to.
Yeah, they're not going to want to do the
work. So a client can show up and say, look, I can't do number 13 today, but I can do number 3 today, you know, in terms of hierarchy of difficulty. Right? I mean, I love that tailoring the treatment to what
absolutely.
A person is, and then you say, no, I'm going to bump you up a little bit out of your comfort zone.
And you want to do
the exposures
together.
I've never heard of that exposure hierarchy. Yeah, yeah, of course.
Absolutely.
So this sounds like a really great, great idea. Great treatment. Exposure hierarchy, folks. Imagine if you went to your therapist and said, well, today I can't talk about that, but I can talk about this. And I will, you know, expose and do some exposure around this. It would make things a lot easier. But I do still think it gets down to person to person. Like, what is it that got in your head in the first place that there's something wrong with my appearance?
Well, I think we could all look back. We're still trying to figure out what are the exact causes of body dysmorphic disorder. It is neurological. Studies at UCLA by a research psychiatrist show that functional MRIs of people's brains with body dysmorphic disorder actually look different than someone who doesn't have it.
Is that true?
Absolutely. So there's an actual physical difference in how the brain looks. Mm. So this is not just vanity. This
yes,
is an
exactly.
actual brain disorder. And we are doing, you know, hopefully we'll have much more tailored treatments and medications for people specifically for it. But this should show you that the people who have body dysmorphic disorder, their brain is functioning differently. They look differently. They process differently.
Yeah. And not everybody can afford to get a brain imaging.
Correct.
Diagnosis.
Right.
So we have these things about the mirrors and the checking and the
absolutely.
Skin. Talk a little bit about skin excoriation because, I mean, it strikes me that this disorder is sort of like picking at a scab.
So it's oftentimes and it's related to but not exactly the same skin picking.
Right.
So there's actually a separate diagnosis for like trich, which is picking the hair, and then, you know, skin picking as well.
Trichotillomania.
Yeah. Yeah. But – there is people with BDD that do picking. They'll oftentimes do self-surgery because they'll actually do surgery on themselves.
How, could you give an example of that? Or
so I've heard people – I've never done it, but I've heard people like take, you know, whether it's dermatological tools, and they'll kind of – if they think that they have blemishes, they'll really dig deep in their face or even try to give themselves like a nose job.
Gosh.
I mean, people are just struggling so bad out there that they'll oftentimes do really horrific things to their face because they're just they're just struggling.
They can't bear to even look at themselves.
No.
Yeah.
And it's
I could see it around braces, you know. I mean, I'm not saying – but a young kid so often – I would say for boys, getting braces can be like a really traumatic experience. So rather, you know, to halt that, they might do certain measures to avoid getting braces.
Right.
You know, I mean, I could really see the fear and the shame and the social outcast that some boys feel when they get their braces, that it could be a BDD potential.
I think there's a lot of potential that we need to look at. And I think that that would be great is, you know, if teachers, if parents were more aware of these things. Oftentimes people get misdiagnosed for many, many years until they get a proper diagnosis. So if we had the tools and people understood what this was, then maybe we would have more early intervention and proper mm-hmm. diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't have the dismal outcome that we have, which, you know, people are really struggling and have some serious mental health issues with this disorder.
Yeah, and I think it would be helpful for dentists to, like, consult with kids in advance about, you know, the shame and the fears and the problems that might come with braces and just talk it out. And if you go into this in advance, being able to, as a 12-year-old or whatever, talking about it with a grown-up, you know, you might not have to carry this. And I think it could probably grow into a severe disorder if you go through this all by yourself. And so we can interrupt these things early on.
I agree. And I think that that leads back to, you know, education and advocacy, which we have to do a lot more of. And I really, as you can tell, I'm very passionate about it.
You're gritting your teeth. So we're going to come back to that for sure in the second half of the show. And we're going to take your calls because BDD shows up in certain obsessions, right? I mean, we're typically more obsessed with different areas of our body and different types. And we'd like to get callers who have actually suffered from this or suffer from a kind of obsession with their looks. And, you know, we have a person here in the studio who is clinically diagnosed and is brave enough to share it with us. You can do it and give us a call at 212-757-5555 after the break.
That's right. Yeah, we're going to just take a short musical break. And again, that number to call, we'd love to hear from you if you've dealt with this body dysmorphic disorder. 212-757-5555. We'll be back shortly after this.
Don't go changing to try and please me. You never let me down before. Mm-hmm. Don't imagine you're too familiar, and I don't see you anymore. Times of trouble, we never could have come this far. Mm-hmm. I took the good times, I'll take the bad times, I take you just the way you are. Don't go trying some new fashion. Don't change the color of your hair. Mm-hmm. You always have my unspoken passion, although I might not seem to care. I don't want clever conversation. Never want to work that hard. Mm-hmm. I just want someone that I can talk to. I want you just the way you are. Need to know that you will always be same old someone that I knew. Oh, what will it take till you believe in me the way that I believe in you? I said I love you, that's forever. This I promise from. Mm-hmm. I couldn't love you any better. I love you just the way you are. Baby. I can talk to. I want you just the way you are.
Billy Joel here on WBAI. You're listening to The Positive Mind. And we're talking about how we can get to
a
place.
Ben, I have to say, I love you just the way you are.
I love you too, Kevin.
Just the way I am.
Just the way you are.
Thank you.
And that's what we want to talk about today is how we can get to a place where we can love ourselves just the way we are. And that's why we have Robin Stern, our guest today, an expert in BDD, body dysmorphic disorder. And we're taking your calls at 212-757-5555. If it's something that you've struggled with or you've seen a loved one go through, struggles with how you see yourself physically, how you your feelings about your physical appearance, there's a range of people who have dealt with this. It goes across gender. It goes across age and all kinds of demographic
Absolutely.
Lines.
Yeah.
So 212-757-5555, number to call.
Body dysmorphic disorder. And so it does often start in adolescence, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that would give credence to the chemical aspect of it or the neurochemical, biological aspect of it. Because adolescence is a time of massive hormonal change and disruption.
Right.
And the birth of shame.
I think so. I think even bullying is a huge factor that comes up with people that have body dysmorphic disorder and starts to happen in adolescence.
Sure it does.
So yeah. Someone who's predisposed to body dysmorphic disorder from a biological standpoint, which we now know from studies at UCLA is factual that people with BDD have different brains. Our brains look different. Mm-hmm. We would understand then why bullying could actually bring this disorder out more in someone who actually is predisposed to body dysmorphic disorder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was bullied as a kid. Now, I sometimes wonder, did that make my body dysmorphic disorder come out? Maybe I biologically was predisposed to this,
yeah.
But did that incident in school when I was bullied for my appearance, did that actually prompt BDD from coming out?
I think that some of the toughest bullying is
yeah.
girls that bully other girls around looks.
Absolutely.
It's so vicious.
It's horrific.
And I remember that from growing up, how rough that was. We have a caller on the line. We have Phyllis on the line. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
Hi, Phyllis.
Hi. I just wanted to thank Robin for doing this
It
is really important to get the word out. I have a son who has body dysmorphic disorder, and I can tell you that he was misdiagnosed by an entire staff of professionals. And I thought they knew more than I did, so we went with it, which also meant that the treatment was ineffective because he was misdiagnosed, and it took about 9 months to get a proper diagnosis and begin proper treatment. And I can tell you that the book that she referenced, The Broken Mirror, that's what led me to the diagnosis, and I had to print those symptoms and take it to a therapist.
Thank you so much, Phyllis. I really appreciate, I actually know Phyllis very well. We met at the IOCDF this past summer. Phyllis is one of a great mom that's an advocate for body dysmorphic disorder. And I think it's really important that you've been out there speaking about this and educating other people on this.
So how long did it go for the misdiagnosis, Phyllis?
I can speak freely about it now because my son does. Because like Robin said, he would not speak about it. But now he speaks publicly. And when he does speak publicly, he finds out that, oh my gosh, I'm really not alone. There's a lot of people out there that will reach out to him because they recognize themselves. He was admitted into mental health, and I thought, he came to me and said, I can't live my life like this. And we didn't have a clue what was going on.
Yeah.
And so they said he had anxiety and depression,
right.
Which he did. He did, of course,
sure.
You know. But they missed the core diagnosis. So actually at that point in time, I started researching it. Mm-hmm. And I And I realized, no, there's something more going on. But then I thought, well, you just go to a therapist and, you know, they treat it and he's good.
Now that he's gotten targeted treatment, I mean, did it make a big difference once the diagnosis was correct?
Go ahead. I think this kind of sums it up. He could not leave his bedroom. If we asked him, and this is August 31st, 2009, and it's a long road. It's not. It really is kind of like sometimes it's like, you know, one step up and one step back,
sure,
and six steps up. So it takes time. And,
yep,
and he had to, not until he really got proper treatment from somebody who absolutely knew what they were doing and had specialized training, did he start to get better. But I can tell you that he has gone from someone who could not leave his bedroom. If we asked him to go get the mail, he couldn't do it. He had no life. He had no friends. And this summer, he traveled to Ghana and worked on a human rights project.
Fantastic.
Absolutely. It's gradual.
Phyllis, what's so great is that Eric really has been such great in terms of doing his treatment, doing exposure work, and he's gotten so much more of a quality of life now due to treatment. And I think that that's the lesson we can learn here, is that with proper diagnosis and correct treatment, we can have a great quality of life. And I want to thank you so much for calling in.
Thanks, Phyllis.
I do want to just say one more thing.
Go ahead.
What is important is treatment is ongoing. It isn't like, you know, it's kind of like if you had epilepsy.
Like
you wouldn't just quit going to the doctor now because I feel better. So there was a time when he didn't go, and he just kind of like, I don't need this, and then it came back and got him. So,
thank you for saying that. A lot of people think, oh, once they start feeling better, okay, my treatment has stopped, and that's not it. You need to keep going until as long as he's been suffering for it, that's how long it's going to take for him to feel really right in the world. But we have to thank you, Phyllis, and thank you for thanking Robin. She's really courageous here. Isn't this great therapy?
Yeah, really.
Maybe we'll have Eric on one day.
Hey, he would do it.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, listen
thank
for our
you.
Number at the end of the show. All right, thanks for calling.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Have a good day.
Number to call, by the way, 212-757-5555. Talking about body dysmorphia with our guest today, Robin Stern. I'm Ben Starr here with Kevin O'Donohue. Robin, thank you for being here, by the way. It's really been...
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I mean, I've learned a lot just hearing and talking to you on and off the air about this condition.
Yeah. And there it is. I mean, a person who can't leave... He couldn't even go get the mail.
It's very disabling. And yet, I think the biggest thing is the shame factor. We don't talk about that.
No, we don't.
I think because it comes back to appearance. And so when we say, Mom, I can't leave the house because I feel repulsive, that just doesn't feel right to say it.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
We just often come across as someone who has depression or anxiety and not realizing that this is actually a biological, neurological disorder that has very, you know, straightforward treatment that could actually give you a better quality of life. Mm-hmm. And it really, you know, people can really get better from this. This is not a sentence where you can, when someone says, I have body dysmorphic disorder, I can no longer have a good life. I'm an example of the opposite of that. I have 2 master's degrees. I have a life. I have a loving boyfriend. I have a loving, amazing family. And I'm able to be okay. Just because I have this doesn't mean this is going to dictate how I live my life. I've learned through the right treatment. Now, that doesn't mean I don't have these thoughts anymore. It just means I learned how to cope with them differently. I've learned how to challenge them. I've learned how to go against what those thoughts were telling me.
And the future looks bright.
I hope
so. You know, I think when you've been through a trauma or a difficulty like this, especially at a young age, you know, you learn a lot of skills just by sheer repetition of exposing yourself to the scenario, the situation, and mustering the courage. Because it takes a lot of courage to talk about this, I'm sure. I'm absolutely sure that it takes a lot of courage. That, you know, what else is there that you have to deal with in life once you've dealt with all of this? I imagine, you know, they're coming out with now a treatment called post-traumatic growth.
Wow.
Instead of post-traumatic stress. And they're showing that people who've been through a couple of traumas actually are stronger than they would have been if they hadn't had the traumas. And they're actually stronger than other people because they've suffered the traumas. And they've dealt with it and they've talked with it and they've looked it in the face. So We have another call.
Yeah, we have Amy on the line. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Amy.
Hi. How are you?
We're good. How are you?
Okay.
What do you have to tell us about body dysmorphic disorder?
Well, I was just wondering about the role of society. Like, for instance, she said she had electrolysis.
Yes.
They're constantly talking about women having hair on their face, you know, on
yeah.
television and stuff like this and what you should do and this and that.
Right.
So how does that relate to the fact that you personally, you know, are therefore, if you feel you have this problem, are being reinforced by society in that way? How
Do you have your radio? Do you have your radio on, Amy?
It's in the other room.
Could you? Yeah. Could you turn it off?
Okay. All right. Hold on.
Yeah. So it's a good question. What about the social reinforcement of the shame?
I think that, you know, we live in a society where beauty is. Yeah. Is talked about. I mean, so that I understand that we are in a society where commercials talk about cosmetic procedures or facial treatments or things. Everyone wants to look younger. So does that mean that you have body dysmorphic disorder? No. Again, I think the cornerstone is that what comes along with that.
Yeah. Go ahead, Amy.
If you do have body dysmorphia, and you deal with this, and you also deal with other people feeling this way. It's just a question of having these feelings and overcoming them. Is that it? Mm-hmm.
I think it's looking at those thoughts that you have. I think once you get the diagnosis, a big part is challenging those thoughts using cognitive behavioral therapy. People with these thoughts, the thoughts isn't just that they're unattractive or have slight facial hair, because some people have that. That doesn't make them someone who has body dysmorphic disorder. But if they cannot live their life and their life is being compromised by these thoughts or compulsive behaviors, we need to look at what that is. We need to challenge those thoughts through CBT. And like I talked about, doing the exposure of going out there, even adding to those perceived thoughts by making them more noticeable, showing us that we cannot look perfect and still be okay to function. So it's retraining the brain through CBT and getting that reinforcement through doing exposure therapy.
Amy, do you struggle with this yourself, Amy?
Acting to people, the fact that people do react somewhat to your problem.
Well, I think that oftentimes, we live in a world, I tell my clients all the time, especially people who have body dysmorphic disorder, they don't want to hear compliments or people talking negatively about their appearance. And unfortunately, we can't control what other people are going to be saying about us. So we need to have a strong sense in us in terms of treatment so that when we get out there and we're exposed to that, I remember I used to think, how could anyone make a comment about a pimple I had on my face? I'm just going to lose it. Sure enough, about 6 years ago at a school I was working at as a guidance counselor, someone did and made a comment about a huge pimple I had on my face. And honestly, because I had so much treatment at that point, I just kind of laughed and I walked away thinking how stupid they were for saying something like that. Who talks about someone's thing? Yeah. You know? So you've learned.
Does that make sense to you, Amy?
Well, a pimple is not a permanent condition. So
no, it's not. But the idea she is saying is that you get enough treatment and exposure therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy that what other people say about you does not have an effect. Now, if you have something that's really troubling you and you can't get over it, you know, you say, just get over it. Well, that's not a remedy. That's not going to help. You know, you need to be in a place where you can discuss it and you can just say, well, I accept, you do enough therapy where you say, I can accept myself. I can accept this about myself.
Right.
You know, it's not an easy road. There's no question that it's very, very difficult. No question. Robin, you've been struggling with it for how many years?
I've had body dysmorphic disorder for diagnosed 15 years, I would say much longer than that.
And you use daily exercises and ideas and changing thoughts.
This is a lifelong journey. Exposure response prevention, challenging the thoughts I have. I mean, obviously there are times in my life where it's not as pervasive, but you know, I think that in general, you have to retrain your brain. And there are times where things come up and I have to challenge those thoughts. Still.
Amy, we have to take you off the air. We thank you for calling us.
Thank you, Amy. Take care. 212-757-5555 is the number to call. We might have time for one or maybe two more callers before the top of the hour.
But that's the core of it, right? She probably has something that she's struggling with that other people are noticing, and she might not have clinically significant distress. She's
right.
able to do her life, but it's bothering her enough that people are pretty much dictating how she feels about herself.
Right. And I think that even if you don't have clinically diagnosable body dysmorphic disorder, I think people can benefit from using this type of treatment no matter what. I mean,
sure.
I think everyone has faulty thoughts about themselves or aspects of their life. I think behavioral therapy is utilized in many diagnoses. So challenging those thoughts, looking at alternative explanations for what. I think the biggest thing I love to see is I tell my clients, thoughts are not facts. Just because you have a thought doesn't mean they're a fact.
Yep.
And I think we oftentimes, especially we have this fusion of thought, and we think that a thought is therefore must be factual. And that's not the case.
212-757-5555. We might be able to get in one or two more calls. 212-757-5555. Yeah, can you replace a negative thought? Like, you know, can you get to a place like, hey, friend, there in the mirror, you know, like what used to be antagonistic and really difficult to deal with. Is there any place in the therapy where you can say, befriend yourself and say, oh, okay, you know, so I have a pimple, but gosh, I have beautiful blue eyes.
So that's really great. That leads us into mirror retraining, which is another aspect of the treatment for body dysmorphic disorder. Oftentimes, someone who has BDD will be extremely judgmental in how they explain their features. So they'll look at their face and they'll talk negatively from top to bottom, using adjectives that are not positive. Mm. So when you're talking and doing mirror retraining, I usually like to tell people to be two arms lengths away from the mirror and be objective as you speak and describe yourself. And the reason you do that is because you have to retrain your brain. People who have this disorder, their brain automatically is negative in terms of how they view themselves. So it's retraining. Mirror retraining is super critical.
That's terrific.
We have time for one last phone call. We have Laura on the line. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. Yes, I have a friend for like 10 years ago, which at the time they didn't have a definitive for that word, dysmorphic, mm-hmm. but she lost her job as a nurse, making over $50 an hour because of this illness that kept her in the mirror all morning, and, you know, she couldn't get there on time. And I had another one that the same way, and every time we go out, I don't care where we're going, they constantly have to stop at Estee Lauder counter, Lancome, because they figured that one cosmetic is not going to happen. The other one will, and they've spent, and it also costs you money, the finances of this, and time.
Sure.
That's all I wanted to add it to that conversation about this sickness is really serious.
Costly. It costs money.
Thank you so much for sharing. I really appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
And sharing about your friend.
Thank you, Laura.
Yes.
And showing that it really impacts your functioning. Your friend is smart. It's not people who have this disorder are intelligent, educated people.
Yeah, she is. And beautiful at that. There was nothing wrong with her face, but still, if you pass a cosmetic kind, you got to stop.
Yes.
I mean, it's like, oh my God, we're not going to get where we're going.
Right.
You know.
Laura, I'm going to recommend something that you do with your friend. Instead of taking her to the Estee Lauder counter, stop her and tell her, let's make eye contact for 30 seconds.
All right.
No mirrors, just you and her. Eye contact.
Right.
And it won't it won't cost you a dime.
Sure.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Bye.
Talk about eye contact. Is that one of the
100%.
Treatments?
I think I even noticed myself at times not making eye contact.
Yeah.
I have to make sure that I'm always making eye contact. I think people who have body dysmorphic disorder oftentimes will avoid making eye contact with the thought that that would mean that someone can see their perceived defect.
Right.
So that's actually one of the behaviors would be to look away, look down, and not look face to face. I hear a client tell me, I don't like when someone looks at me in the face because then that means they're looking at my perceived defect. Again, that's the faulty thought.
And there is the, you know, paradoxical intervention where if you're looking at somebody in the eye, it must be very, very difficult. But it's a paradox. I'm going to pull myself out of this by looking at somebody else, not protecting myself and my wound, but actually making eye contact with somebody.
Absolutely.
So we're going to close up here, but you're going to be back tomorrow. You wanted to dedicate this show to somebody. Why don't you tell us, Sue?
So 2 years ago, we lost an amazing OCD, BDD therapist and advocate, Dr. Bruce Hyman, who without him, my recovery would not be here. And I will forever be grateful for him and want to continue with his legacy. And I will always be grateful for the treatment and the strength that he instilled upon me. So thank you, Dr. Hyman.
Gratitude is a treatment also.
Absolutely.
So we're going to be back tomorrow talking again with Robin Stern. If you know anybody who has OCD or BDD, or even if you yourself have a little something that bothers you when you look in the mirror, you know, and who doesn't? And
absolutely.
Speaking of mirrors.
Oh.
Modern day mirror was invented in Germany. In 1835.
Interesting.
Perfect.
Mass marketed mirrors today are because of Justin von Liebig. In 1835, he discovered the use of silver on the back of a glass can create a mirror.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you, and we look forward to seeing you again tomorrow, Robin.
Great, thank you.
You have been tuned into The Positive Mind here on 99.5 FM WBAI. You can find us on the iTunes Store. It's a free podcast. Just go on the iTunes Store, search for Positive Mind, and you can get any episode that you missed live delivered to your computer for free. You can also find us online at positivemind.com and give us a call here at the center, 212-757-4488.
Yeah, and if you'd like to get in touch with Robin, you can call us here at the center and we'll channel the call to her, 212-757-4488.
I'm Ben Starr here with Kevin O'Donohue and our guest today, Robin Stern. Thanks again, Robin. We'll see you tomorrow. All right, take care.
Bye-bye. Thank you.